and on many podcast sites and mobile apps. You can also find our podcasts and much more on our website, newdimensions.org.
We're speaking today with Mirabai Starr. And I'm wondering, again, we talk about having our own personal experience, and we also have talked about some of the masters that have come before us. But I'm wondering what that middle arena is about community and even an intimate relationship one-on-one with someone.
Yeah, there's a lot of that in this book because I'm a very relational creature myself. And as the child of activists, I have a strong sense of beloved community and our responsibility to tend at all beings, including those who we will never meet. Valerie Kaur says that you are a friend I have yet to know and see no stranger. In my conditioning, there is a bridge that just unfolds from personal spiritual path to relationship with people I love to care and concern for the whole, which extends beyond the human community, by the way, to the animal family and to the earth herself.
Absolutely.
Yeah. So I think that when you walk the path of the mystic, which just means the path of direct experience and contemplative presence, being with what is, that's very much what this path seems to be about. It opens up a space for our sense of connectedness to others. I'm just not the slightest bit interested in my personal self-improvement project anymore. I was for a long time. I worked really hard. I was like the best meditator in the class, you know? And it's not what matters anymore. And I think for a lot of us, that is the case. That private salvation, personal liberation, my enlightenment is not what it's about. There is, it's irrelevant and it's not even real. And in fact, it causes a lot of suffering, this idea that there's some kind of end result of the spiritual path.
It's amazing. You said it's not even real. It reminds me of the Ubuntu phrase we hear, I am because we are. Yeah. I may be saying that incorrectly, but something that says there is no I without the we.
Yes, exactly. Yeah. That's it. And I think that there's a maturing going. I know there's a lot of evidence to the contrary, but in the human family, certainly in all the spiritual communities that I'm involved with, but I'm not, you know, I don't have much contact with, say, evangelical Christian communities or Pentecostals or other more fundamentalist versions of religion. But in the spiritual communities that I come into contact with, there seems to be an agreement that it's not about our own personal awakening, but it's about lifting everyone. It's the bodhisattva vow that I'm not going to opt for enlightenment when everybody else is still suffering. I'll wait. But it's also, I think what you're also asking is about intimate relationships being a place where we find the face of the beloved, that in our own beloved, say, in our own partner, if you happen to have one, that you may behold the face of the divine. And that can be difficult because when we're in a partnership, often we get into the kind of petty finding and pointing out of flaws. I mean, it doesn't mean we're not attracted to our partner anymore. We don't still have a loving relationship, but there people get into those habits.
Projecting our own self-improvement project onto
them. Yeah, exactly. Yeah. Of not seeing it and not seeing the face of the beloved in the beloved. And so there are ways that we can practice that, you know, dropping the critical voices and making an effort, even if it's a ritual that the other person doesn't have to know anything about. My husband would roll his eyes if he knew I was creating a ritual to see God in him. Keep that to myself, but
okay,
it's easy to do.
But he knows who you are and what you do.
Yes, and he lived in ashrams for decades, so it's not like he's been on the path. He just loves to make fun of it all, which helps me a lot. It helps me not take myself too seriously. It really does. But the point is, you don't have to be like all precious about it. Mm-hmm. You find ways to celebrate your most intimate relationships that have humor, that have that are grounded in real life. And yet it's the intention. You know, that so much of this is about cultivating your intention to look through the eyes of love and perceive love.
Yeah, I could feel the shift in the resonance of your voice when you were speaking about him, both with your intention and then the humor. So I think you transmitted very well your practice of that in the relationship, even though he might not call it the same thing.
Yeah, right.
Yeah. Well, great. So let's use that as a stepping stone, actually. Maybe there's a listener that just was changing the stations and came across this interview. And, you know, so many people are feeling disconnected and overwhelmed in the world today with the demands and the technology, and AI is coming right up. And so I'm just wondering if there's any more practical first steps that you might want to offer to someone to start making the shift of intention.
Yes, thank you. So one thing would be to cultivate mini Sabbaths.
Okay.
Find moments in your day where you can breathe and center yourself in the present moment. The reason I hesitated just then is centering yourself is part of that self-improvement project language.
Right.
That I'd rather live without. But it's breathing in to the present moment when you're in the middle of rushing around.
It's that paradox.
Yeah.
Again, right? It's like the jazz masters in music had to practice their scales before they got to say, just play what you feel.
Right.
Yeah.
So I've had a lot of experience with contemplative practice, and it does feed in to my everyday life, no doubt about it. In fact, I'm not quite sure about this whole everyday mystic path if I hadn't spent hours of my life being still and listening to the quiet and breathing.
You have such transmission in your voice. And there's that relationship of silence and breathing and listening that is so closely connected also to the human ways that we use language. And there are the texts and the intellect that, if we're not too careful, can become the hindrance or the focus, but is a wonderful companion as well. And so I'm just wondering that, what role language has played for you as a companion to silence?
Mm-hmm. Well, I'm a writer, so I worship at the altar of words in many ways. In fact, I sometimes say that I've made my living writing and speaking about silence. And that is very much what I end up doing. So the spaces between the words are very captivating for me more and more as I get older. I still love the poetry and beauty of language. I have no patience for I call them pretentious, pedantic, didactic, discursive spiritual books. The preachy ones that speak in grandiose, abstract terms about the life of the soul and the life of the heart. And so the more specific and embodied language is, doesn't ever have to reference the G word, God. But if you're writing or speaking from a place of embodied experience, it becomes sacred. It opens into a space that is filled, brimming with the presence, the divine presence.
You can feel this in the mystical poets.
Yes.
Rumi, of course, and Rilke and Hafiz.
And Mirabai, my namesake, and Rabia and Lala. And there's some mystics in there too.
That's great. I was hoping to get a longer list from you. Because when I find it too, you can read it on the page and it's there, but also when I speak them into the room, it's like a larger envelope.
Isn't it incredible?
It is incredible.
A poem out loud. And this book is also full of writing prompts, because for me, writing is a spiritual practice. So I work a lot with people on, you know, meditation and writing. And it is my way to open up a space where the sacred can flow in. It's the one of the most reliable spiritual practices that I have and that I share with people.
Yeah, I love that. Each chapter ends with a writing invitation. Would you like to share one of those with us now, perhaps?
It's called Surrender. Here we go. Let's see what this
idea
one.
Of radical amazement.
Yes, exactly. Surrender, radical amazement. The prompt is simply, I am amazed. Uh-huh. I am amazed. So that's one of the many prompts in this book. Well, there are 7 of them.
The prompts in the book are simple. And that struck me immediately. There wasn't much direction. There wasn't much over explaining. It was very short and to the point, and wherever I wanted to take it.
Yeah. I do have a course on work at your own pace course. I think it's available on my website, and it's called Embodied Writing, where I give poems, prompts, and a lot more kind of guidance, but it's something people can do at their own pace as opposed to, you know, signing up for something on the calendar.
Fantastic. Mm-hmm. Great. So I kind of want to come back to the relationship part just for a second. And you said maybe your husband would roll his eyes if you were doing this practice or something. And so, but I'm wondering about entering into a practice or something together.
Yeah. So at the risk of TMI, we have a big bathtub. It's called a tea for two. And at least once a week, and usually more, we take a bath. And this is our sacred ritual. I think we both, if like separately, if we were on one of those old game shows from the 60s and they'd say, what is one of the most sacred things? Or what do you think your partner would say is one of the most sacred things in your relationship? We would each say the bath. We light candles. We have music. We put our phones in the other room so we can't hear any alerts. And we just literally sink into the moment together and just allow the fragrance of the, you know, what's in the bath and so on to just permeate our hearts.
I'm speaking with Mirabai Starr, author of Ordinary Mysticism. If you want to learn more about her work, go to mirabaistarr.com, or you can get there through the New Dimensions website, newdimensions.org. I'm Travis Glenn Sabera. You're listening to New Dimensions. We're speaking today with Mirabai Starr and the myriad facets of ordinary mysticism, touching in relationship, community, love. And earlier in the program, we spoke a bit about suffering. And I'm wondering, Mirabai, if you could talk a bit about the story with Maddie and what that experience was like for you.
Mm-hmm. Sure. So Maddie was my big brother, and he was diagnosed with a brain tumor when he was 9 and I was 7, and he died a year late. I was almost 8 and he was 10. And his death just kind of granted me access to something both mysterious and beautiful somehow. I didn't have language for it. Nobody else was talking about it as beautiful. That would have been, I think, offensive to my parents and other people who were grieving my brother. But there was something intensely alive about his death and my feeling of closeness to him. And also this feeling I had of grace. I mean, I of course didn't call it that, that came seeping into the shattered container of our family. Mm-hmm. And I was so little, you know, but I definitely was a very watchful child, and I was paying attention to the almost the quality in the air, you know. And so I started doing this thing where at night when everybody was asleep, I would crawl out of my bed and in the room I shared with my baby sister, and I would go down the hall to Maddie's room, which was still the same. They had figured out what to do with it. Mm-hmm. And all his baseball stuff and, you know, his little boy stuff was all there. And I would climb onto his bed and kind of curl up and face the wall. I would face the wall, and I began to see the shape of a woman's face. And she was beautiful. And she had long, flowing hair. And it was dark, but it was clear to me that her face was also dark. And her hair was also dark. And her eyes were dark. She was a dark-skinned, dark-haired woman. And she was looking at me with unconditional love, but not sentimentality. She was fierce. It was almost like Kali in the Hindu tradition. She had that ferocious divine mother quality of, I am going to protect you. I'm going to love you. And nothing is going to stand between us. I won't let anything come between us. I will liberate, you know, that's Kali's. I just certainly wasn't thinking that way as a 7-year-old, but
right.
That liberatory energy of Kali that wasn't coddling. It was freeing. And I came back night after night for I don't know how many nights, probably weeks. And there she was, and then she wasn't anymore. Mm-hmm. But something in that experience of intimacy with this feminine, powerful figure that came to me in my little girl broken heart stayed with me for the rest of my life. And this connection between love, death, and beauty, mm-hmm. this braid of those three strands has always been there for me. And so subsequent shattering losses have also led me to a place where I felt held by the mothering darkness. Mm. And it was beautiful. At the same time that I may have been as in when I experienced the death of my teenage daughter in a car accident, unbearable anguish. It didn't lessen my unbearable anguish. It simply accompanied me. Beauty, feminine holding, and access to something sacred beyond all imagining.
Ooh, so powerful to feel that. And what I hear in that movement as a 7 or 8-year-old is literally you were making contact with the fullness of the experience.
Exactly.
The devastation and death, but you literally went into the room. Hmm. You didn't stay away. You met reality as is and was given this gift of the braid that you discovered.
And I think we all know this innately, ways to show up completely.
And I wanted to ask you about another chapter title for attention, subheaded A Fearless Gaze. But I think you also just articulated that that may have not have been a conscious intention as a child, but you went in there with a fearless gaze.
Yes. Yes. And I think that's what the mystical path is about. It's about daring to look at reality. Mm-hmm. To, as one mystic, I can't remember who said, take a long, loving look at the real. Or what Father Richard Rohr, my dear friend, talks about, that the contemplative gaze, which is the gaze of love. Mm. And Richard, in his elder years, actually practices what he calls gazing. He just kind of spontaneously called it this. He sits on his porch, and he lives in the inner city of Albuquerque, and it's not a pretty place, but it's New Mexico, so there are always wildflowers and deep blue skies. And he just gazes. He looks around wherever he is and shows up and gazes. And I love that. And that is a practice that I try to emulate in my own life.
You really hit the key word of our times in the first two chapter titles, of attention and intention. And so this gaze that you're talking about contains both.
Right. Where you set your intention to walk as a mystic and to perceive the presence, the presence with a capital P, and you pay attention. Annie Lamott, who was actually the person who gave me the idea to write this book, she literally said, Mirabai, you need to write this book. She quotes Bill Wilson's advisor, a priest named Father Ed, I think, who said, sometimes I think heaven is just a new pair of glasses. So the mystical gaze is just putting on those glasses.
That makes sense to me. And in your story of Maddie, you were evoking the feminine principles as part of the tradition. So I'm wondering, specifically, is there a role that the feminine plays in this ordinary mysticism?
Yeah, you know, my last book, Wild Mercy, mm-hmm. was all about reclaiming feminine wisdom across all the spiritual traditions. And that informs everything that I do and am, is this reclaiming of the voice of the feminine, which is one of tenderness, of mercy, mm-hmm. and compassion, also fierce truth-telling, also embodiment, you know, staying with our embodied experience and not trying to transcend this world as some kind of illusion that we're going to wake up from, but actually embracing mm-hmm. this fleeting incarnation as a place that is blessed, that is holy, even when it's mundane and boring, and even when it's excruciating. This is the place where we get to wake up and step up.
It's so fascinating. As you put in the list fierce truth-telling as a component, my mind actually flashed to Srinisargadatta Maharaj, book I Am That. People always asked him to organize, to make a principle, to start a club and gather people around him. But he said he couldn't bring the same fierce truth-telling if it were an organization, if people were there to worship him.
Yes.
That he continued to sell cigarettes, and people came to his shop to listen to him, but he felt that organizing would take away that fierce truth-telling capacity.
That's beautiful. What a great example.
And what a great example to also hear that as you bring it into the feminine principle as well.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and I'm not talking just about women when I speak about the sacred feminine. I'm speaking about that principle, that reality that lives in all of us and people of all genders.
Yeah, great. So is it so helpful then to separate the feminine and masculine principles when we have these conversations?
Maybe not as much as it was. Although, Travis Glenn, the truth is, it is so skewed, it being, you know, the human community, religion, art, politics,
that
I think you can't overcompensate, you know, and it's important, I think, to go ahead and consciously, intentionally lift the voice of the feminine as much as possible. I mean, yes, ultimate reality is non-binary. I think we can all agree.
And we certainly have the harm caused very much as the patriarchy as well.
Right. So we have some reckoning to do, I think, before we leave that distinction behind, even though we encourage each other to not make that the final word.
Yeah. Well, I love our conversation today and really hearing not the dissolving of the ordinary, but the ordinary as one with the mystic.
Right. Our everyday lives are not an obstacle to spiritual experience, to mystical oneing. They are the way through, and we're reclaiming all of it as blessed.
I've been speaking with Mirabai Starr, author of Ordinary Mysticism. If you want to learn more about her work, go to mirabaistarr.com. Or you can get there through the New Dimensions website, newdimensions.org. I'm Travis Glenn Severa. You've been listening to New Dimensions. This is program number 3828.
New Dimensions Radio has been making a difference on our planet since 1973, thanks to the generosity of our listeners. You too can help make a difference with a tax-deductible donation or membership. Please visit our website, newdimensions.org, and just click the donate button. You can also subscribe to our free weekly podcasts and find over 1,000 hours of audio dialogues in our searchable archive. New Dimensions is produced by New Dimensions Radio in Santa Rosa, California, USA. Our executive producer is Justine Willis-Toms. Our post-production editor is Lou Judson. For over 4 decades, New Dimensions has been producing weekly conversations at the leading edge. We sincerely thank all of you who have supported us by being members of Friends of New Dimensions, as well as members of our affiliate stations. My name is Dan Drayson. On behalf of everyone at New Dimensions, whose endeavors make this program possible, I'm wishing you well. New Dimensions Radio is an independent producer supported by listener contributions. To find out more about the program you've just heard, to subscribe to our free weekly newsletter and our New Dimensions and New Dimensions Cafe podcasts, and to access thousands of other programs in the New Dimensions archive, please visit our website, newdimensions.org. That's newdimensions.org. Or call us at 707-468-5215. That's 707-468-5215. Please join us next time as we explore New Dimensions. New Dimensions is brought to you by Friends of New Dimensions membership support and by Larson Publications, publisher of the book An Open Life, Joseph Campbell in Conversation with Michael Toms. New Dimensions and our quarter-hour New Dimensions Cafe programs are now available worldwide as podcasts. You can find them at the iTunes Store and on many podcast sites and mobile apps. You can also find our podcasts and much more on our website, newdimensions.org. Each week, New Dimensions explores the social, political, scientific, environmental, and spiritual frontiers with some of today's foremost social innovators, thinkers, scientists, and creative artists.
Hello, I'm David Bedrick, author of The Unshaming Way. Next time on New Dimensions, I'll be talking about a workable and accessible path to divesting ourselves from shame.
Hey, Canada, we need to talk. Canadians want a healthy climate, but things keep getting worse. Wildfires, droughts, and floods are driving up the cost of living. There is a way forward. You don't have to face this alone. With Citizens Climate Lobby Canada, you can do a lot. Working together, we can create lasting climate solutions. Visit citizensclimatelobby.ca and step into your power with Citizens Climate Lobby Canada.
The staff and volunteers of CJSF wish you a safe and happy holiday season.
You're listening to